This is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guest. In this case, it's David Harris. And it's not just intelligence I'm after here. He's a great writer. He was a great activist. He went to prison for 2 years for his draft resistance back in the 60s. Late 60s was when he went to jail. And he's written 10 books. He's been an important public intellectual. But I want to get at a core issue here of integrity in life. And coincidentally, because one of David Harris's most important essays, journalistic efforts, is a essay he wrote, actually, I think is his first professional writing after coming out of prison, being a draft resister and one of a group. And there's, by the way, I'm going to promote it later, but there's a movie that came out last year called The Boys Who Said No about this resistor movement. These are not people who fled the country. These are people who refused to cooperate with the draft board. And a good number of them, thousands of them, were punished for that, along with David Harris. And then when he got out, as he said, divorced and broke, he was actually divorced from a famous person, Joan Baez, who also played a key role in the anti-war movement. He had a child, and he tried to take up writing. And the first place he wrote for was Rolling Stone and Jan Wenner. And he did a piece called Ask a Marine. And that Marine is Ron Kovic, who is now much more famous than he was back then. And in preparing for this interview, I call Ron up, who's a good friend of mine. And, you know, one thing we got to remember about war, the casualties in the case of ex-Marine Ron Kovic can send you right up to now. Fortunately, he's still alive. He's paralyzed. And the elevator went out in his building. And so I got in a whole discussion with Ron about how is he going to get help and how is he going to be handled. And fortunately, my wife is on that case now, so I can turn to David Harris. But Ron Kovic said that article in Rolling Stone, Ask a Marine, just changed his whole life. He was full of despair. He didn't think he could ever get his message out that he'd been, as opposed to David Harris, he had eagerly enlisted in the Marines. He believed in the war, and he thought he should go. And he did two tours of duty and famously wrote a book called Born on the 4th of July and other books. And but that particular interview, which was included in Rolling Stone's 25-year collection of its major pieces, is something I just reread in preparing this. And I felt the need to call Ron Kovic and ask him what he thought about it. And he just was thrilled with it. It just made him come alive. And let's just begin with that. I know Annie Leibovitz, who, you know, now is probably has been the most famous photographer in the world, went down to, I guess it was Santa Monica where he was living, and did the whole photo display. So why don't you talk about your own transition from being an anti-war felon and that moment in your life, and then writing this piece about a warrior who went with enthusiasm and suffered these horrible injuries and turned against the war.
Well, I was dealing with the dilemma that everybody who had dropped all else and gone to try and stop the war had when peace agreements were signed. Suddenly, what we wanted to happen happened. And now we had to answer the question, what next? And in my case, I didn't have much in my bank account, and I was in a joint custody arrangement with my ex-wife. I had dropped out of Stanford 15 units short of a degree. So I was eminently unemployable from every angle. And but I thought I could write, and I had contact with Rolling Stone because they'd done a story about me when I got out of prison. And so I sent off a letter to Jan Wenner and said I'd been writing a bunch of radio editorials in the last year of the war. And I sent him a bunch of them and said, these aren't getting in print. Were you interested? And he wrote back saying, no, he wasn't interested in those. But if I would wanted a tryout, he would give me one and give me an assignment. And I said, I want to write the Ron Kovic story. And it was, for everybody who knows the story, it was an archetypal story. I mean, all the elements came here. His initial devotion to the Marine Corps, his disillusionment, and his reincarnation as an anti-war activist had all the elements of an incredible story and a message. And I knew Ron from movement days, and I went after it and leveraged the experience I was coming out of to get into the experience that I was headed for.
Well, let me just say something about that. It is one of the most compelling pieces of writing that I've ever encountered, and you capture his life in Massapequa, Long Island, and in many ways not that different than your life in Fresno, California, where you were what in high school? You were the Fresno Boy of the Year or something.
Fresno High School Boy of the Year.
Yeah, and you were a true blue patriot and not a rebel against the system or the culture, which is what Ron was. There, you had a class difference. Ron went straight from high school into the Marines, and you were, I forget, student body president at Stanford University, right?
Yeah.
And, a future a presidential candidate and senator was in your dorm where you were the dorm advisors, right?
Mitt Romney was one of my advisees.
And so in a way, you're a very important story because you walked away from a huge career, obviously very bright, the meritocracy and so forth, Stanford, you're on your way. And you didn't go to Canada. I'm not disparaging people who went to Canada or didn't, but you didn't take advantage of student deferments, which you could have. You had many deferments that you could, and clearly a lot of people from Stanford who didn't want to go didn't have to go, and other colleges, particularly elite colleges. But you wanted to you took a principal position. And I want to get to that because we've forgotten what that was all about. And it really was a reenactment of the Nuremberg Standard. What you were saying is you thought the war was criminal and you could not participate in it. And that was it. And it was really scary to go off to prison over that. And it was originally a 3-year term. And then you were paroled after 2 years, and Ron was the other side of that coin. And when I talked to him today, you did more than just were there. You were in part his inspiration to come out against the war. He had heard you speak, and you very much influenced him, and you gave him a whole focus that if you could make that sacrifice, then he should speak out. And he had seen the war. He had done 2 tours as a Marine. And he felt you were, in a sense, inspired him. And he even remembered that you had a kind of a farm up in Fresno and for that resistors to the war, where some of them were staying there and so forth. And he said he visited there with you. Do you recall that at all?
Oh, yeah. I remember him. We ran a way station for people who were getting out of prison or who were getting out of the military, needed space to make transition.
What I want to get at here in this is that the journey that you and Kovic followed was a journey of high principle and sacrifice, on all accounts. And we now treat war as a video game. One accomplishment of the anti-war movement is they got rid of the draft and have gone over to high tech, which kills a lot of people in these countries, which is what was happening in Vietnam also with the carpet bombing and everything else. But we forget that there's a core principle. And I was offended, actually not by the article, but I read an article about you, and one of the things it goes into, and I should mention here, that you've had serious medical problems, and at this point in your life, you're kind of looking back at what was worth it and what was important and so forth. But this fellow, Alan Goldfarb, and I think it was a well-intentioned article, but what got me going in that article for Alta magazine was that he interviewed some people who in the government or in foreign policy service around this many years after this war that no one could defend. And actually they made the argument that you might, people like you, and I guess people like me, because I, by the way, I spoke at that same Kezar Stadium rally that you spoke at.
Yeah, I remember.
but what was so interesting, the snide, arrogant view that somehow, you know, there were other ways to stop this war. And, you know, in my own personal case.
Well, they had even accused us of extending the war.
Yeah, yeah. And I found that so deeply offensive and so out of tune with reality, because these wars were fought as if it didn't matter how many of the others got killed. Nobody ever really cared about the destruction in Korea, where just about every structure was leveled. Nobody really cared that we dropped more bombs on Indochina than we had, you know, in World War II in Europe and so forth. And it was a question of whether it was politically palatable in the United States, whether it would hurt your career or not. And Nixon even campaigned on the promise to end the war because it was increasingly unpopular. But the smugness of this view that somehow the establishment, and, you know, David Halberstam had that great title for his book, The Best and the Brightest. They gave us this war. They justified it. And that somehow people like you who took a principled stand, and this is what I recommend to people to watch this movie, Boys Who Say No, and David Harris is a principal figure in it. The courage it took to say, wait a minute, if this involves war crimes, how could we go along? And we're not just going to duck for cover or leave the country. I shouldn't say just, because those people had their lives very much disrupted and threatened. But really, you had these, 25,000 people who, you know, in a methodical way, sent their draft card back to the draft boards or the Defense Department and said, no, this is immoral and we can't go along. I think there are very few people who would now defend what happened in Vietnam as moral. But if I were to suggest, for instance, President Biden just went along with declaring the genocide against the Armenians to be genocide, to be a war crime. And I'm not disputing that. But the matter of fact, we never recognize any American genocide. We don't recognize
which is a good Native Americans. Which is a starting point for what I did and what Ron did. You know, was we got to, particularly those who didn't live through it, who are now trying to familiarize themselves with this war, the starting point is that it was wrong with a capital W. This was not just a matter of mistaken policy. This was going 10,000 miles from home and killing 3 million people for no good reason. You know, it's a textbook definition of evil. And that confronted everybody who came of age during that time with the question of what are you going to do about it? And obviously I was, and Ron and a whole bunch of other people were part of saying that for starters, we weren't going to participate. And there was a system of military conscription that was in place and required everybody to register, all males to register on their 18th birthday and be subject to being called up into the army. And everybody was required to carry proof that they had registered with them, which was a card that was that you were issued by your local draft board. under penalty of potentially 5 years in prison. And what we said as a movement was, it's time to stop your cooperation. It's this system only works because everybody does what they're told to do. And they may not want Stanford students to draft.
We are given to an American exceptionalism. When we do bad things, they're mistakes. You know, oh yeah, okay, a lot of Native Americans got killed or what have you, but that wasn't really intentional. It wasn't the main drama. That's an improvement over, you know, the cowboys were virtuous and blah, 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 that we're raised with. Slavery was a mistake, but, you know, it was a part of the times, and then segregation. Well, we go through this whole mythologizing, and the picture on your book, and I do want to recommend this book from Heyday Books, dear, because it's a collection of great journalism. You know, great journalism. They're individual pieces on very different subjects, you know, ranging from marijuana growing to war and what have you. But it's journalism at its best. And it's the kind of journalism that had a currency in the 70s when you were doing this and really has fallen out of favor. It's not done with that kind of edginess that you did. And you did it for quite a few publications. So I think people should get the book. But I think the main thing is we don't ever take ownership for our history. And whether it's dropping the only country has dropped nuclear bombs on civilians and people, used them in war, we don't. And I want you to address that, because there you were on the path to great, you know, financial success. You could have become, you know, I don't know what, become a lawyer or something, got Harvard from Stanford. It's the route, careerism. And I think we've lost that edge. You were part of a generation that thought not selling out was an important consideration, that integrity might matter. At least a lot of people felt that way. Certainly the woman you were married to, Joan Baez, exhibited that. And that is kind of lost now. And the idea that you went to prison over this principle, how many people would go to prison over their objection to the Iraq War if they were called on to fight in it? You know, they wouldn't, or very few would. And so I want to address that. You're a still living monument to that kind of integrity. And in the cover of the book, you're wrapped in the family American flag. You know, you had the same convictions that Ron Kovic had, and you lost them because of a reality check, both of you.
Yeah, I wanted to go to West Point when I was in the fourth grade. And my father was 20 years an officer in the Army Reserve after serving World War II for the duration. And my brother was a captain in the 82nd Airborne Division. So it wasn't like I came from a pacifist family. But I think one of the things you have to remember about this period of time is that nobody started out in this position, that there was a collective search for meaning and response that was very painful on the individual level and very challenging on the larger political level. But, you know, all of us had to make two decisions. One was that we were not going to participate, and whatever the consequences of that were, we weren't rolling over front. Second choice was, what are you going to do about it? And we went looking for people who were prepared to put themselves on the line and ante up. You know, our approach to the anti-war movement was, you know, it's fine and good to have an opinion about the war, but we need to take that another level and make it clear what's going on here, and do that by dint of our own personal sacrifice. That we were saying to America, look, this is such a hideous proposition that we're prepared to spend time in prison to try and stop it. And I think ultimately that played a big role in changing the minds of the Americans that ultimately forced the war to end.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest. But why doesn't the model hold? Because, I mean, in this story, and I don't want to put down the story that was in Alta. I think it's by Alan Goldfarb. I think it's well worth reading. I'm really angry. I mean, I think it's a very good story. I'm upset about some of the establishment figures and, you know, I don't know where, the Council on Foreign Relations or whatever, that he quotes. They know the wise way. There's an internal mechanism. It's the same thing that's been said about Edward Snowden or Julian Assange or any whistleblowers, Daniel Ellsberg, for example. You know, there are channels. And what you were saying is, no, there are not channels. The fact of the matter is, this war is proceeding. It's not stopping. There's no intention to stop it. And we're actually in, I want to bring it up again, the Nuremberg Principle, something that came out of U.S. government, you know, that and as a kid, you know, because I came from, well, you wouldn't know, but I come from a German Protestant father and a Russian Jewish mother. And I was up against this, you know, how was my father's relatives involved in this barbarism? And you know, I went back to find my father's brother who was in the German army. And his answer was the same that you got from a lot of people who went off to Vietnam. He said, hey, I was a farm boy and they came and we were conscripted and we went and I ended up in Stalingrad, you know. Well, we you know, held people like that accountable. What did you do? Where did you, what were your activities? What were the orders? Why did you follow the orders? That was the whole question. And what you did was in real time said, hey, that's a question Americans have to answer.
Yeah, I remember that when I was a freshman at Stanford, the kind of hot book at the time was Hannah Arendt's account of the trial of Eichmann in Jerusalem. You know, she reaches the conclusion in that the issue is not what do you do if you're the rest of the world faced with the Nazis. The issue is what do you do when it's your country that is the Nazis? What do you do if you're a German? And that framed the next 10 years of my life, because we were Germans. We were committing an enormous evil and refusing to recognize it, hiding it in all the different ways that possible, and using love of country to justify what is palpably evil. And we had to go out and set up a new moral standard. And I think... to our credit, were able to at least keep the country from falling into total moral oblivion. But getting the country to take responsibility has been was difficult at the time, and ever since has become more difficult. America does not want to remember what it did. It does not want to take responsibility for what it did. So it continues to do it over and over again. It's not until somebody has an accounting here that we're ever going to get out of this cycle.
You know, one of the key phrases in Hannah Arendt's work was the phrase, the banality of evil.
Yeah.
This keeps, when I read, you know, accounts about what you did and so forth, there was always kind of a snide banality of evil lurking there and attacking you. You know, why were you doing this? And weren't there better ways? And aren't there smarter people to know how to do this? You know, is it really as awful as you're describing? I happened to go to Vietnam before the heavy bombing, and then I was in the north after, and I was in Cambodia quite a bit, couple of times. And you know, it just would hit me that anyone who went through that in any way, I was a journalist, I wasn't like Ron Kovic, but you would see the evil around you. You just cannot look at carpet bombing and what it does to a whole rural population. And somehow we made that seem ordinary. We made it seem normal. And what you were penetrating was that fog of normalcy, it seems to me. What you were really saying is, no, this is it. This is the same kind of thing. And I don't think it's just a period piece about Vietnam. What we've done is now turn war into a video game, right? And as a result, we don't have a draft. And so the issues that you are raising are still issues. Our taxes support wars that make no sense, like in Iraq, elsewhere. We're still building up a big war machine, but we've made it even more common, not questioned. It's just, we have a huge military budget right now in the middle of a pandemic. And so here you are, kind of a artifact of a peace movement that really doesn't exist anymore. It's kind of depressing, isn't it, at this stage of your life? It certainly isn't mine.
Yeah, no, it's watching everything we built slowly be ebbed away. And there is no moral discussion going on other than in the Black Lives Matter movement. Otherwise, the notion of moral responsibility is getting incredibly short shrift in our culture. And the fact is, democracy, as we learned in Vietnam, was that democracies only work when citizens act out the democracy. Citizens are not supposed to stand around and watch. Citizens are supposed to frame the politics of that moment. And right now we don't have that kind of citizenship going on.
It's interesting. We're going to wrap this up, but I think it goes even beyond the questions of war and peace and so forth. I mean, I was reminded the other day, I just looked at the statistic, when we were talking about Vietnam, and so we used to say the U.S. had 6% of the world's population, and it was responsible for a lot of waste, a lot of war, a lot of this sort of thing. Now it's 4.25% of the world's population. And yet, if you look at a whole range of issues, certainly climate change and waste and, pollution and so forth, you look at the consumption, you look at the amount of wealth that is wasted. At the same time, there's so many people who don't have the necessities of life. You get a darker view of American exceptionalism. It's not just the wonderful good guys screwed up once in a while, which was one view of Vietnam. Maybe it's systemic. Maybe this is what we are. Maybe we are the bullies. Maybe we are the wasters. It's kind of a harsh message that, most people, even people who consider themselves progressive, don't really want to accept.
Yeah, and then on top of that, it's the exact wrong response to the situation we're facing. We're not going to solve the fallout from climate change by building better weapons or bullying people. It requires us to build a solidarity as the human species. And so that all of that cowboy stuff is the exact wrong response to what we need.
Let me close by asking you, we look back at your life and what are the touchstones? I mean, something very special happened in the 60s and 70s. It's a mixed bag, but something very special happened where suddenly at least discussions of integrity, personal integrity, became front and center. And reading your account of that period, it's there. It's there in the dorms. It's there in the endless discussion. If that's true and that's true, then what's the right thing to do and so forth? And it seems, and then you even talk about the media at that time reflecting that. You know, it's not my country, right or wrong. What should my country do? What is my role? What is accountability? And now, and with Stanford actually sort of a center of this shift over to this internet billionaire world, where, you know, what's big and what sells and what makes money and how do you get on that career track? And your life has been lived in exactly the opposite way to what most universities now recommend for the successful life, which is careerism trumps everything. How do you look at this period? What has happened to Stanford or other major
universities? Who's asking the question of who are we? And I don't see it happening. Because the next question after who are we is what's right and what's wrong. And these are the biggest questions human beings have. And you can't be a full human being unless you have explored those questions and found answers. And I think that's been lopped out of the culture. And we lose as human beings from it, not just as a body politic, but we lose as individual human beings. We become less so. And we become social engineers and leave democracy behind.
Yep. So any regrets?
Not a one. You know, I mean, part of what when I was doing this back then, I used to tell myself, I want to get to be 75 years old and look back on it and feel good about what I did. And I look back on it at 75 years old, and I feel very good about what we did. I think it was special. I think we saved the country from itself, at least momentarily.
And you know, and that's an interesting point, the success of that movement. And one thing I keep getting back to this, and people should read it for themselves. It's a good article by Alan Goldfarb, and it's Alta Magazine. That's what Will Hurst puts out, right? That's a good publication and everything. And I don't want to blame Alan Goldfarb for the quotes that he has from these so-called realists who say, oh, well, they just lent in the war and so forth, because that's a convenient stand for careerism. You know, why did Daniel Ellsberg do what he did in releasing the Pentagon Papers and, you know, risking 125 years in jail? Why did Edward Snowden tell us what, you know, is really going on in the surveillance state? And the fact is, the scary thing is there's so few of them. Daniel Ellsberg said he had to wait 3 decades or something for another whistleblowers to come along, you know, and when he was talking about Snowden. It's really quite amazing in a society that prides itself on individual integrity and freedom and accountability and democracy and holds that as a single world, that we have very few David Harris's, very few Daniel Ellsberg's, very few Edward Snowden's. And that's a question I put to you. What is it about this culture that denies its assertions for individualism and obligation?
Well, and it's important to remember that it wasn't always such an isolation. These guys who are talking about us having extended the war couldn't be more wrong. And one of the things we have to remember about this history is this was the only war in American history that was stopped because a citizens' movement rose up and made it impossible for the government to continue. It was an extraordinary moment in history that we keep turning a blind eye to. when, what's his name, the documentary filmmaker who made the 10-part series on Vietnam and managed to
Ken Burns, you mean? Yeah.
Ken Burns, and managed to pretty much ignore that central fact that it was the uprising of citizens that made this war impossible to continue. And that involved millions of people.
Well, I know that is true because I actually got to interview Richard Nixon after he was in office, after he was disgraced and went back to his office in New York. And he had been traumatized by the anti-war movement. This doesn't mean that led to good behavior. He escalated the war and so forth, but eventually had to get out. It wasn't enlightened liberals that finally ended it. It was cold, calculating Nixon, and recognized that this world was far more complex and that the simplest, after all, the whole rationale for the Vietnam was that somehow Vietnam was a surrogate of China, because they were both had communism in, around them. And no one, I really, this is a good point on which to end because of the, just having talked to Ron Kovic today and realizing paralyzed, he has to stay on the third floor of his apartment building because the elevator hasn't been working for days and there's nothing to do. And how is he going to get the help he needs to even get out of bed? And why was he sent to Vietnam? That wasn't because there was anything in Vietnam that mattered. It was that this was a surrogate for fighting China. And there had been this revolution in China that, you know, we thought was awful and caught us by surprise. And now we were going to punish him. You know, first was in Korea, and then it was going to be in Vietnam. And the irony, and just conclude on this for people listening, because you teach and speak in high schools and other places, and I know I do teach. I always ask people, well, you know, we were told the war in Vietnam had to go on or they would challenge us in San Diego, where, you know, there was this international communist threat, you know, denying that it was nationalist or anything. And the irony is that the great experts on war, the great strategists told us, oh, this will be terrible for America's place and so on. And the fact of the matter is, when we suffered the most ignominious military defeat in American history, at the hands of a really relatively poorly armed, basically peasant army, what happened? You ask that people that question, even pundits. What was the military consequence? Did the Vietnamese attack San Diego? What happened? And the fact is, it was communist Vietnam and communist China went to war. Then they went to war over their border and over some islands and so forth, which is still hostile. So the whole foundation of this war, which sent you to prison, which cost Kovic 3/4 of his body, was a fraud. It was an act of stupidity. It was oblivious to fact, logic, anything. And yet none of the people who brought it all together, who sold it, who packaged it, who directed it, were ever held accountable. None of them. Is that not true?
It was the great, one of the great wrongs of the 20th century.
And but we talk about accountability. We raise children to be accountable. We talk about accountability. We hold a shoplifter accountable, and they do it a couple of times. They're gone for 10 years. You know, we hold people accountable around the world. And the idea that this folly, it's not the only one, but that this folly was constructed on a totally, this is what the Pentagon Papers showed. And they were going to throw Ellsberg in jail for 120 years for what? Revealing an internal Pentagon history that showed the whole thing was a fraud, you know? So Ron Kovic shouldn't have been sent, and you shouldn't have been faced with the resisting the draft. I mean, this is the part I don't get. When you read an article and they quote some people saying, well, the war would have stopped earlier. That's nonsense. They don't understand the hysteria of militarism. That's what you were going up against. How dare you challenge the patriotism? How dare you break with the government? How dare you endanger the lives of American troops by objecting to the war? That they were trying to make you a non-person, the enemy. Was that not what you went, the buzzsaw that you walked into?
Absolutely. That was what we had to change. And it was by dint of a lot of people's sacrifice, we shifted that, where suddenly it was no longer possible to portray anti-war people as unpatriotic. A country came to see that we were motivated by patriotism every bit as much as the people who were for the war. And that was an enormous achievement.
Well, on that note, you know, as Ron Kovic always says when he sees somebody in uniform and so forth, he says, "I thank you for your service." I think American people owe David Harris a thank you for his service in trying to prevent the war. If the people trying to prevent that war had been more successful, Ron Kovic would not be paralyzed right now on the third floor of an apartment building worrying about how he can survive. So I really think these lessons cannot be forgotten. And just because you now do them by drones, you do them anonymously, there are human beings on the other end of those drones. So again, David Harris, wish you all luck with your health problems. And I want to thank you for being one of the great symbols of American democracy. And that's it for this issue of Sheer Intelligence. Christopher Ho at KCRW posts these shows. We want to thank him. Natasha Hakimi Zapata does the introduction. Lucy Berber, the transcription. And Joshua Shear is our overall executive producer. I want to thank the JWK Foundation for, in the memory of Gene Stein, a terrific writer and someone who did oppose the war in Vietnam, helps fund these shows. See you next week with another edition of Sheer Intelligence.